Israel's response to the coronavirus was a model for the world, until it wasn't.
What stopped working was, of course, that Israel didn't build the mechanisms during the lockdown and after the lockdown.
Also ahead, white supremacy recruitment has flourished on social media.
It sucks you in and sends you to more and more extreme content, and that's a really dangerous thing.
But some online platforms are starting to clamp down, and American tourists in Ireland are doing what tourists do there, heading to the pub. But they're supposed to be quarantining on arrival.
I turned them away, yeah. Yeah, I had to. For the safety of my staff and the other customers, I turned them away.
I'm Carol Hills. Those stories and the history of the ninja ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Should I stay or should I go? That's been the question many international students in the U.S. have been asking themselves. Earlier this month, the Trump administration announced that international students would be required to transfer or leave the country if their schools held classes entirely online because of the pandemic. After numerous federal lawsuits and an outcry from hundreds of universities, the administration rescinded the rule. The announcement brings relief to thousands of foreign students, including Marco Ribeiro. He's a rising sophomore studying engineering at Harvard. Ribeiro is from Portugal and would have been forced to leave the U.S. He spoke with us from Harvard's campus in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
2 weeks ago, we received the decision that we couldn't attend in-person classes at Harvard. And in the same day, we also knew that according to the new ICE guidelines, we would have to leave the country by the end of the summer. And that came with a great shock. And we had just a few weeks to plan. And we really needed to leave according to the guideline. Knowing that the government pushed back that decision came with a big, big relief for us. And I received the news and I was very happy about it.
So you had not gone back to Portugal after classes shut down because of COVID. You were waiting it out here to see what would happen.
Yeah, exactly. Because there was a lot of uncertainty and a lot of travel bans in place that were put in place, especially with the European Union very early. And so I decided also to minimize like the COVID risks, to not to travel. And the university gave me the option to stay here. So I accepted that. And so that was the main reason I didn't go back. And also because if I went back, I couldn't return at this point, for example, because there are travel bans in place. Mainly because of all the uncertainty going on, I decided not to go back.
So since Harvard shut down, along with every other university around early March, have you been staying in the dorms?
Yeah. So the Harvard University, they prepared us like some dorms with social distancing and everything. They gave us rooms and also like a meal plan and everything as before. And so we stayed here respecting all those rules, but we are on campus housing, yeah.
Now, if I understand this correctly, Harvard is allowing freshmen and seniors on campus. So you, as a rising sophomore, you'll live in your apartment and then do online courses? Is that how it'll work?
Yeah. So essentially, Harvard is going online for all years. However, freshmen in the first semester and seniors in the second semester are allowed to be on campus. So they still have some on-campus experience. But sophomores and juniors are really not invited to campus for the whole year.
Marco, I'm wondering whether your family back in Portugal is actually kind of concerned that you'll be staying here, whether online or not, just because of the situation here with the pandemic, which is kind of not coming under control.
Oh, yeah, they are surely concerned about that. Like, I would say that the whole world is very concerned about what is going on in the U.S. right now. Everyone hears the news everywhere. And of course, like they keep saying to me that I should really social distance. And of course, I respect all the guidelines and it's very important. And of course, even by living with friends, we would be in a very small group and avoid contact with other people because it's a serious threat. And I would say that especially here in the state of Massachusetts, things are not doing as bad right now, which is really great news. But as we can see, there are several hotspots across the nation, which pose a significant threat. And it's true because, like, I talk to my parents almost every day, and they tell me that in Portugal right now, nobody's wearing masks, and there are almost no cases already. So it seems like they already gone through this pandemic. And right now here, we are still in a very bad situation.
Marco Ribeiro will be a sophomore at Harvard this year. He's from Portugal, and he's studying engineering sciences. Thanks a lot, Marco.
Thank you very much.
China sends more students to study in the U.S. than any other country, by far. But many Chinese students are rethinking their decision to come here.
I thought maybe I can meet a lot of friends in America. Also, I plan to do a lot of things, but now I just can't go there.
An education consultant in China says she's been getting lots of questions. Where else can I go?
Definitely, I've been receiving questions asking about Singapore or other European countries or Canada rather than America. And this trend has been going on, I would say, ever since 2018. I've been constantly receiving more requests on this front.
We'll have that story tomorrow. About 8,000 students from Colombia come to study in the U.S. each year. For them, staying in the U.S. or going back home is looking like a choice between two bad options. As coronavirus cases are spiking here in the U.S., they're also continuing to rise across Latin America. In Colombia, officials are bracing for the country's peak in infections expected next month. Right now, they're reporting about 7,000 cases daily. And as the world's Jorge Valencia reports, the mayor of Colombia's capital, Bogota, is taking an unusual approach to flattening the curve. She's ordering mandatory isolation, but only in parts of the city.
The mayor of Bogota is a political scientist. She has a PhD from Northwestern University. And so naturally, as a teacher, part of Claudia López's response to the pandemic has been to educate. This past Sunday, she put on a white mask and gave an online PowerPoint presentation. I want to explain to the city, she says, what we're doing and why we're doing it.
En agosto vamos a tener el mayor número de personas contagiadas y a muchas llorando.
In August, López explains, Bogotá will have its highest number of infections, and many people will be mourning the deaths of their loved ones. Bogotá, a city of about 7 million, leads Colombia in cases. This week, officials reported more than 53,000.
Vamos a hacer cuarentena estricta en todo Bogotá, pero por turnos.
So we're going to do a strict quarantine, López tells her viewers. A handful of the city's boroughs will take turns doing two-week isolation periods for 6 weeks until the end of August. The idea is that by reducing the number of people leaving their homes, there can be some economic activity while slowing down the spread of the virus.
Yeah, I honestly have doubts about that.
Dr. Andres Vecino is a researcher with Johns Hopkins University. He says he agrees that Bogotá needs mandatory isolation because the city's intensive care units are already near capacity. But he paints a hypothetical. If someone lives in one borough that is in lockdown and works somewhere else that's in lockdown 2 weeks later, they're effectively at work for a month. Vecino says they may break the rules just to go do their job.
My perception is that you have been best to lock down the city for 14 days. So everyone would actually be locked down for only 2 weeks. It's a deeper impact in the economy, but it's only 14 days.
Vecino says officials in Bogotá have made great strides in pandemic response. They've allocated payments of about $70 so the poorest families in the city can feed themselves while they're at home, and they've increased their testing capacity exponentially. But that's not enough, he says.
Definitely what the city, after having all these increases in testing capacity, needs to do is to scale up the tracing and the isolation strategy.
In southeastern Bogotá, where many live in poverty, local borough mayor Anderson Acosta was doing field work yesterday in a neighborhood called New Delhi.
Porque acá trajeron al embajador de la India, entonces por eso lo pusieron Nueva Delhi.
Acosta says they named it New Delhi after the ambassador from India visited some years ago. Acosta says that in his borough, crime increased after the city lifted its initial mandatory isolation measures a few months ago. He says homicides more than doubled compared to last year, and so has the robbery of bicycles.
Ahora en pandemia es muy difícil, o más bien es muy riesgoso andar.
Acosta says that's because people are avoiding public transit and are opting for bicycles. Acosta says the Red Cross has delivered more than 18,000 grocery baskets in his borough since March. He also says he's been doing education efforts and that his borough is now offering 2,000 free tests per week.
Que nos unamos y trabajemos juntos.
The only way through the pandemic, Acosta says, is to work together. For The World, I'm Jorge Valencia.
Last weekend, some American tourists did what most tourists do in Ireland. They got off the plane and headed straight out for a pint. Many pubs in Ireland have just reopened after a long coronavirus closure, and the Americans were thirsty. But they seem to have forgotten that American visitors are under strict orders to quarantine upon arrival. for 2 weeks. Noel Keane is the owner of Cree Restaurant in Tralee in County Kerry. He joins us now. Noel, so Americans came looking for a table this weekend and wanted a pint. What was the problem?
Well, yes, and thank you for talking to me. On Sunday evening, I had Americans come to the door looking for a table and asked them when they arrived. And they had arrived on one group had arrived on Friday and the other group had arrived on Wednesday. So they hadn't done their quarantine.
So did you turn them away?
I turned them away, yeah. Yeah, I had to. I have to, given obviously the whole COVID-19 situation and we're just coming out of it here, for the safety of my staff and the other customers, I turned them away.
And did they seem to get it?
One table just kind of shrugged and walked away, said nothing. And the other table just said, well, I don't have COVID-19. Well, that's not how it works. You know, the quarantine rule is there for everybody's protection. So I refused to give them tables.
Is it just American tourists or are visitors from other countries also kind of not getting the quarantine thing?
Right now, the only ones I've come across was the two tables of Americans. Obviously, that situation may change over the coming weeks with other European nations going on holidays.
When did you reopen your restaurant?
We're back open 2 weeks.
And what does it look like now at the Cree restaurant? Do you have indoor seating, plexiglass, tables 6 feet apart? Kind of what does it look like?
We're down to 50% of normal capacity. Tables are 2 meters apart. We have sanitizing units throughout the building. The staff have done multiple courses on service in a pandemic. We've put in all the measures that were required here by law to reopen after 4 months of closure.
Noel, what's the most challenging thing about running a pub during this pandemic with these restrictions?
We have new, obviously, government guidelines on how we operate, which are taking a bit of getting used to because it slows everything down and you have to have your social distancing. And obviously you have the reduced capacity as well at the same time. Then you're almost policing the door as well to make sure that the people are supposed to be obeying the laws that they're obeying. And it's something we didn't envisage that I would have to ask people these questions. You know, all of a sudden it looks like I do. Look, I feel sorry for the people that made the trip. They probably planned well in advance of this. We're supposed to have 14-day quarantine on arrival. And if people aren't adhering to it, well, you know, I've got to take the safety of my staff as my first port of call. And if that means, unfortunately, turn people away, then unfortunately, that's what I have to do.
Noel Keane is the owner of the Cree Restaurant in Tralee, Ireland, in County Kerry. Thanks for speaking with us.
Not at all. Thank you very much. And stay safe.
It was just too good to last. We have an update on a story we told you about yesterday, how street artist Banksy had transformed a London subway car into his canvas, or at least a person believed to be the artist went into the London Underground and painted some art. Stencils of Banksy's trademark rats on the inside of one of the trains. Banksy uploaded a 1-minute video to his Instagram and YouTube pages that showed the spray painting being done. He painted an image of a rat sneezing out a lot of mucus, another rat with hand sanitizer, and some rats with face coverings, a public service announcement to help stop the spread of the coronavirus. But the art installation was on display oh so briefly. The Transportation Agency for London scrubbed the works off the walls last night. London transport officials say the works were removed because of a strict anti-graffiti policy, but they are hoping Banksy might be persuaded to do some more tagging. They said in a statement, "We'd like to offer Banksy the chance to do a new version of his message for our customers in a suitable location." Well, we have a suitable online location for it. Check out the video of Banksy, or the person we think is Banksy, painting that subway train. It's at theworld.org. And you're with The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Hate speech and extremist content are not allowed on most major social media platforms, technically speaking, that is. In reality, global networks of white supremacist and other extremist groups have flourished online, gaining big followings and doing recruitment work almost unchecked, according to watchdog organizations. There's been a huge backlash, and now some online platforms are beginning to crack down. The World's Lydia Amanalidou has our story, and a warning, parts of Lydia's report are disturbing.
Last week, Heidi Byerick and her team reached out to YouTube and Twitter after discovering a slew of white supremacist pages on their sites.
What we wanted to do was to say, you need to get this off your platforms. This is directly tied to terrorism. It is irresponsible for you to be hosting this content.
Bayrick is with the Global Project Against Hate and Extremism, a U.S.-based nonprofit that tracks white supremacists online. Last week, her organization came out with a damning report. It identified dozens of YouTube and Twitter accounts belonging to Generation Identity, a multinational extreme far-right organization with chapters in Germany, France, the Czech Republic, Ireland, Australia, and elsewhere.
We looked at this group in particular because it is responsible more so than anyone else for spreading the ideas of the Great Replacement.
This is a racist conspiracy theory. The idea is that in Western countries, white people are slowly being snuffed out or displaced by non-white immigrants.
It's obviously a flawed notion and makes no sense, but this is the propaganda that these people believe in
and have been spreading through social media. The accounts Bayrick and her team found on Twitter and YouTube were linked to Generation Identity chapters in more than 12 countries and had tens of thousands of followers.
I wish it was hard to find them because then maybe other people wouldn't find their accounts. But it was actually very simple.
All she had to do was basically type their name in the search bar in different languages. She found some accounts, and then the platforms pretty much did the rest of the work for her, suggesting similar people and groups she could follow or subscribe to. This is one of the reasons the algorithms these companies use to suggest content are considered so controversial.
It sucks you in and sends you to more and more extreme content. And that's a really dangerous thing, and it's the bedrock of why we have so many young, largely white males who are getting radicalized into white supremacy around the world.
Since 2018, Bayrick says, there have been at least six attacks motivated by Great Replacement ideas, including the terrorist attack at two mosques in Christchurch, New Zealand last year.
An alleged killer in court, appearing defiant, making a hand signal associated with white nationalism.
The gunmen had ties to the Generation Identity movement and named the Great Replacement conspiracy theory in his manifesto. When Bayrick and her colleagues brought their findings to Twitter and YouTube, the companies took action. They removed dozens of these accounts, including ones belonging to Martin Sellner, Generation Identity's unofficial leader in Austria. This might seem like a no-brainer, but watchdog groups say it wasn't until recently that the big platforms really started cracking down on white supremacists and other extremist and hate groups. Just in the last few weeks, platforms including Reddit, Twitch, Facebook have kicked off groups and individual people, including high-profile figures like Stéphane Molyneux, a Canadian white nationalist, and David Duke, the former leader of the Ku Klux Klan.
Frankly, it's pathetic that it's taken that long. Bans like this are too little too late.
Howard Graves is a researcher with the Southern Poverty Law Center. He says for years and years, his organization and others tried to get social media companies to take the white supremacist problem on their platforms seriously.
We would act as, you know, good faith partners using our limited resources to try and help them identify bad actors on their platforms, and almost nothing would happen.
These mainstream platforms, Graves says, became hubs for extremist content, a place where a range of white supremacist groups could establish sprawling transnational networks to communicate with one another and to recruit. The companies weren't doing much, he says, and they cited free speech. But he says things began to change slightly in 2017, in the aftermath of the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia. White supremacists and neo-Nazis marched through the streets holding tiki torches, chanting racist slogans. One of them drove his car into a group of counter-demonstrators, killing a woman. Graves says this was a moment of reckoning for tech platforms, some of which hate groups used to organize the rally.
I think when the realization set in after Heather Heyer's death of, you know, this is what these people came to do, no matter what they say or what they've said about what their intentions are, this is a clear manifestation of their views with consequences.
In the aftermath, companies started to crack down, but not in the way it's happening today. This most recent wave of purges, activists say, comes amid another moment of reckoning and intensifying public pressure. The police killing of George Floyd here in the U.S. has sparked global protests and conversations about racism and white supremacy, and it's put the spotlight on hateful and racist content that critics say is still rampant on social media platforms. Chloe Colliver is with the Institute for Strategic Dialogue, a global counter-extremism think tank in London.
It's taken a campaign that affects the bottom line of one of these companies, Facebook, for the tech sector to really wake up and take a stance on some of these violent and hateful influencers and groups on their platforms.
Colliver is talking about the Stop Hate for Profit ad boycott that began last month. Dozens of big companies, including Adidas, Microsoft, Patagonia, said they would stop advertising on Facebook because the company has failed to address hate broadly on its platforms. This campaign targets Facebook, but Colliver says other social media platforms are taking notice.
It's revealing, I think, that the financial leverage that brands have is the thing that has really led to swifter action being taken on hate content.
Still, she says, deplatforming is a powerful tactic that can significantly impact the reach these groups have. Joe Mulhall agrees. He's with Hope Not Hate, a UK-based group that campaigns against racism and fascism.
So while it doesn't mean that deplatforming doesn't mean these people disappear, it does mean that they then usually migrate over to either bespoke platforms that are created by the far right themselves.
Or existing smaller platforms like Telegram, Discord, 4chan.
And once they're on those platforms, they essentially are then talking to themselves. Now, that still has its own dangers around their ability to radicalize themselves, their ability to plan and plot. But it means that their ability to reach normal people, engage with non-far-right people, is severely curtailed.
Mulhall says these smaller platforms should also be weeding out extremists. But what's most important right now, he says, is to get the big guys to consistently enforce their policies against white supremacists and extremists, to be proactive and not reactive to media and watchdog group reports. And someday, he hopes these platforms will pay closer attention to extremists outside of North America and Europe, because loads of them, he says, are already weaponizing these sites to spread their hateful messages. For The World, I'm Lydia Emanuelidou.
Just a few minutes ago, we told you about street artist Banksy's newest work on the London subway. The pandemic has sparked lots of artistic creativity across the globe, from museum exhibits you can now visit by car to long-distance virtual collaborations by artists stuck at home. You can see plenty of pandemic-inspired art at our website. Visit theworld.org/coronavirusart. And you're listening to The World. In Japan, you can now take a university course to learn how to kill somebody with a towel.
It's called the Ninja Study Course, and this course is not a joke.
Understanding Japanese ninjas means going beyond video games and into the classroom and diving deep into Japanese history. That's ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of WGBH in Boston and PRX. Joe Biden has a new $2 trillion plan to help save the planet. The Democratic presidential candidate is presenting a more aggressive plan to tackle climate change.
When Donald Trump thinks about climate change, the only word he can muster is hoax. When I think about climate change, the word I think of is jobs.
That was Biden in Wilmington yesterday unveiling his new plan. The World's environment correspondent, Carolyn Beeler, joins me now. What stands out about this plan, Carolyn?
Carol, this plan really does more and faster than the larger climate change plan that Biden's campaign originally announced last summer. That 2019 plan pledged $1.7 trillion in climate investment over 10 years. This one pledges $2 trillion in just 4 years. It also sets a new target for clean energy, so all electricity generated in the U.S. would be carbon-free by 2035. That's a really big change in a really short amount of time, and it's very ambitious compared to what other countries are planning for. I talked to Takeshi Karamochi from this international climate policy think tank, New Climate Institute, and he called the prospect of reaching that goal daunting.
Even the European Union hasn't committed to full decarbonization of electricity in such a short time frame. So even compared to some of the countries that are considered advanced in terms of climate policy, this is one of the most ambitious ones.
So it's ambitious. How else is it different from the larger climate plan that you mentioned Biden released last summer?
It's a lot more domestically focused. So last summer's plan was really painting Biden as the inheritor of the globalist climate policy legacy of President Obama. So it was all about getting back into the Paris Climate Agreement, ending fossil fuel subsidies all around the world. And it really focused on leaning on China to get it to be a more aggressive actor when it comes to climate change. But fast forward to today, we're in the middle of a pandemic. We're in an economic downturn. A lot of people people are out of jobs. So he is rather obviously pivoting toward climate change as an opportunity for jobs. We heard that in a clip earlier. Clean energy jobs, jobs building more resilient infrastructure and mass transit, jobs making buildings more energy efficient, jobs in electric vehicle manufacturing, really framing climate change right now in this moment as a jobs opportunity.
But even as the Biden campaign doubles down on these domestic issues and takes a domestic approach to climate change, I understand China still gets some attention in his new plan.
That's right. China is still framed as sort of the country to beat in developing a clean energy economy. China has pulled ahead as a leader on electric vehicle manufacturing, and Biden says he'll vigorously enforce trade rules and mandate that the government buy electric vehicles to create, you guessed it, 1 million jobs in auto manufacturing, supply chains, and auto infrastructure.
The U.S. auto industry and its deep bench of suppliers will step up, expanding capacity so that the United States, not China, leads the world in clean vehicle production.
So, Carolyn, how likely is it that if he's elected, Joe Biden could deliver on these very big promises?
Well, he would need support of Congress to push through a lot of the initiatives that he has proposed. So that is a question we won't be able to even begin to answer until November.
The world's environment correspondent, Carolyn Beeler. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Carol.
Relations between the U.S. and China seem to be in free fall. The two nations are trading barbs over trade, sanctions, and control of the South China Sea. One third of the world's shipping passes through the area south of China, which touches several Asian nations. In a statement this week, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said, "The world will not allow Beijing to treat the South China Sea as its maritime empire." Joining me now is Bonnie Glaser, a senior director for Asia at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Bonnie, for months, Mike Pompeo has been saying that China is basically acting like the neighborhood bully when it comes to its behavior. But with a statement this week, has the U.S. stance on China's presence in the South China Sea changed?
Well, I think that the new U.S. position is really a clarification and a bit of a toughening of the prior U.S. stance. The United States has opposed Chinese coercive actions against neighbors, interference with their efforts to develop oil and gas that are off their coastlines. But the United States has actually never said that those activities were illegal. And so the clarification of this policy is not taking a position over who owns what land features, but it is taking a clearer position over the maritime rights and resources and who should develop them. And it's clearly saying that China just doesn't have the right to do so.
Now, remind us what the Chinese have been doing in the South China Sea. What kind of incursions or what sort of things have they been doing to try to lay claim to it?
The Chinese have been, on occasion, sinking fishing boats from other countries. And the Chinese have also been interfering with oil and gas exploitation. And the Chinese are sending their survey ships and using their Coast Guard vessels to harass and intimidate the oil rigs of other countries. These are the kinds of things that the United States is saying is now illegal.
Now, the U.S. recently sent two aircraft carriers to the region. Is this a significant move?
Well, the last time that the United States sent two aircraft carrier battle groups to the South China Sea was 2014. So I do think that it is significant. It is a signal to China that the United States is not going to stand silent while the Chinese are seeking to control the waters and the airspace in the South China Sea.
Politically speaking, why is the U.S. taking this on now? What do you think about the State Department's timing?
Well, I think that we've seen increased Chinese coercion against other countries. So I do think it's in response to Chinese actions, but it's also part of a larger strategy to step up pressure on China because of actions that China is taking across the board. We have seen Trump administration tougher policies recently on Hong Kong, where the Chinese are implementing very harsh national security legislation. Also in Xinjiang, where the Chinese have built re-education camps and incarcerating essentially millions of Uyghurs and also Kazakhs. So the South China Sea policy is of a piece. It is toughening Trump administration's policy toward China.
Bonnie, if you were to advise the Trump administration right now on this matter in the South China Sea, what would you tell them?
Well, I think the Trump administration is taking some of the right actions. They are conducting what's called freedom of navigation operations to make sure that the waters of the South China Sea are open to all. I support that. And I support this change in policy. And I would advocate that the United States follow through in a way that it will continue to have on board with them other countries, because we cannot take on China unilaterally. We have to get the support of other countries. So I would advocate coordination with our allies and with individual countries in the South China Sea, Malaysia, Indonesia, Vietnam, Philippines, Brunei, and Taiwan. All of those countries are claimants. And so if we coordinate with them and we try to together put more pressure on China, I hope that we can persuade China to refrain from engaging what are clearly illegal activities.
Bonnie Glaser is a senior director for Asia at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Israel took quick action against the coronavirus. It closed its borders and imposed a nationwide lockdown. The result, one of the lowest infection rates in the world. Back in May, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said Israel had succeeded. Go out, enjoy yourselves, he said. But as the world's Ariel Osaron reports, now, 2 months later, things are very different.
In the last couple of months, COVID-19 cases have spiked in Israel. On Tuesday, a record high 1,600 new cases were recorded. So what happened since the first wave hit?
A lot changed and nothing changed in a sense.
Nadav Ayala has become one of the most prominent public voices in Israel on the pandemic. He's a senior correspondent with Reshet News. Ayala says that getting the public to stay home right away was very effective.
What stopped working was, of course, that Israel didn't build the mechanisms during the lockdown and after the lockdown in order to tackle small to medium-sized outbreaks and prevent them going to a national level.
Unlike in some countries in Europe and Asia, Israel lifted most restrictions all at once. Kids went back to school, wedding venues opened back up. The public started to feel like they'd beat the virus. Ayala says the two key things in keeping infection rates low are testing and contact tracing. After a shaky start, Israel is now a world leader in testing, but the two need to go hand in hand.
If you want testing to be effective, it needs to be done with contact tracing, with an epidemiological approach. And it needs to be done really quickly. You can't do only one thing. You need to do the whole bunch in order to be effective. I would say that it started off South Korea and it finished off Texas.
Israel's effective national healthcare system has kept the death rate relatively low. But the contact tracing system is suffering from a severe shortage of manpower and expertise. It can take up to 6 days to be notified that you've become infected with the virus.
Public health services, they're not designed and budgeted to be able to do it.
Ilana Bellmaker is a former public health director of Israel's Southern District and an associate professor of public health at Ben-Gurion University. She says Israel's public health services are just not up to a task of this magnitude. For example, the country began the crisis with only 27 epidemiological nurses to handle contact tracing. That's 27 people nationwide. They have since added a few hundred nurses to help with the program, but Bellmaker says they're working flat out and are not able to keep up.
They need help. They can't do it by themselves. And as has happened also, I believe, in the United States, national governments tend to, when they have all these competing demands on their budgets, it's kind of always easy to squeeze down on public health services.
She says the public is losing faith in the government's handling of the pandemic. But beyond the health crisis, it's the economic fallout that has many Israelis worried most. The national unemployment rate has soared to 21%.
I think we reached within a couple of weeks that 1 million people are either on leave without pay or have been fired. That's a huge economic impact.
Over the weekend, thousands of Israelis protested in Tel Aviv. They called on the government to come through with the economic assistance it's been promising, but slow to deliver. One group hit especially hard are self-employed Israelis. Lilach Sapir co-owns the Peacock Bar in Tel Aviv. Sapir had to close down her business during the first wave of the coronavirus. Today, she says, she's operating at a loss, just to stay open for her regular customers.
For 4 months of not working, we got only for April an amount which is equivalent to $3,000. That was the maximum. Most of the people got like half of it. This is like nothing. You cannot pay your rent with this amount of money.
Sapir is one of the organizers of the recent protests. She says they will continue to demonstrate with one clear demand.
Money in the bank, not money on TV, not promises, money in the bank.
Nadav Eyal from Reshet News says Israel's government has failed to contain the virus and to minimize the economic impact.
So this is a perfect storm. You have an outbreak of a big proportion, and then you have a government which is not really functioning very well in answering the needs of people. And that's creating a lot of mistrust.
The current surge in COVID-19 cases has brought a dire warning from Israel's health minister. He now says the country is just days away from ordering a second nationwide lockdown. For The World, I'm Ariel Osran.
Tomorrow, we'll hear from a Palestinian health official in the West Bank, where they've imposed a nighttime curfew to try to halt the spread. In the mountains about 300 miles south of Tokyo, university students can enroll in a new field of scholarship, courses that would be very popular with martial arts film buffs. When the new degree program began 2 years ago, many dismissed it as a novelty. But as the world's Patrick Wynn tells us, it's leading to some serious new research about Japanese history.
Genichi Mitsuhashi isn't a 21st century ninja per se. He's just the only person on Earth with a master's degree in ninja studies. I found an online video from the Japan Ninja Council that shows him in action. In this video, Mitsuhashi shows how to kill someone with just a towel. While his classmates studied engineering and medicine, Mitsuhashi, who is 45, he was learning things like ancient combat and espionage.
It's called a ninja study course, and this course is not a joke.
That's Yuta Sakai from the Ninja Studies Center. It's based at Mie University, located near forests that were once Japan's ninja heartland. And Sakai says students there have to do scholarship, learning techniques from 17th century scrolls.
Even Japanese cannot read such old Japanese characters.
Understanding the ninja, he says, means getting away from pop culture stereotypes.
Yeah, everybody know ninja. And most of people think ninja is black costume and bad people.
But they weren't necessarily bad people. They were covert agents, usually a samurai warrior, but specializing in spycraft. Sakai says maybe 1% of the samurai were ninjas.
The most important thing is survive.
To understand historical ninjas, you have to unlearn a lot of stuff from movies and video games, he says. Like, people think all ninjas use throwing stars. They're called shuriken in Japanese. Tourists in Japan can go to ninja shows where guys in black robes throw them with precision. But Sakai says this shuriken throwing star stuff is kind of phony. Ninjas didn't really use them. It just wasn't practical, he says.
You have a shuriken in pocket and running. It's too dangerous.
What ninjas did use a lot, he says, is fire. They like to set fires to distract their enemies, to slip in fortresses unnoticed. And that is a part of the ninja studies course.
We have the laboratory for the fire stuff.
It's like a chemistry lab where students learn about handheld bombs, smoke bombs, even flaming arrowheads.
Unfortunately, students cannot touch this because it's too dangerous.
Only the instructor gets to shoot flaming arrows. Now, on a typical day, Sakai says, ninjas weren't doing anything dramatic. They had swords, but he says they'd rather use them to cut through a wall and sneak in someone's home than face a bunch of enemies head on.
The most important thing is survive.
To stay alive, historical ninjas had to be charming, Sakai says, to seem non-threatening to strangers. People think they were all about violence.
But their skill is make a friend and escape from the war.
In fact, he says they dressed like regular people. Genichi Mitsuhashi, the recent grad, he actually spent a lot of time chopping wood and farming. But what does one do with a ninja studies degree anyway? Well, if Mitsuhashi was in Japan's feudal era, an extremely chaotic time when lots of fiefdoms were battling for power, he could apply for a job, Sakai says, with a warlord. Just like the U.S. has the CIA, warlords also needed spies.
Each warlord has ninjas. They offer the job and they get the salary.
In modern times, Mitsuhashi will focus on running his martial arts school up in the mountains in an area called Iga. As for the ninja studies course, it only accepts a few students a year. Fluent Japanese is required. Still, Sakai says they are getting more applications these days. And I can't help but ask, Mr. Sakai, you're a ninja studies scholar, but do you have any ninja skills yourself?
Oh, interesting question. If I had the ninja skills, I will not talk about it.
Fair enough. For the world, I'm Patrick Nguyen.
We told you earlier about Joe Biden's new energy and jobs plan. It's getting high marks from the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. But to build a path to the White House, Biden will also need to reach out to other key voters, like Latinos. They're now close to 20% of the U.S. population. Each week, we bring you our Every 30 Seconds series, where we profile young Latino voters in the U.S. We're calling it that because approximately every 30 seconds, a Latino turns 18 in this country and becomes eligible to vote. This week, we're heading to Texas, where statewide runoff elections just took place. Reporter Alejandra Martinez from KERA in Dallas was out talking to voters and joins me now. Hi, Alejandra.
Hi, Carol.
Now, we're seeing an increase of coronavirus cases in several states, including Texas. Is that having an impact on voter turnout based on what you saw at the polls?
Yeah, so I think it's too early to tell if, like, this rise in coronavirus cases or this surge has an impact on voter turnout. But despite that, yesterday when I was out at the polls, voters did show up. I spoke to several voters, predominantly in the south side of Dallas. So these communities are Black and Brown. And the people that I talked to, they weren't really concerned. Many came prepared. They were wearing masks. And some even brought their own hand sanitizer and stylus to fill out their ballot. Of those who were concerned, they told me that that's why they showed up early. They wanted to beat the crowd. And this despite Dallas having over 1,000 additional positive coronavirus cases daily for the past week. One of the people that I talked to was Maria Cruz. She's 63, and she came out with her two daughters. Maria has pre-existing conditions. She has cancer. But this condition did not stop her and her family from coming out and voting. This is Maria. She's a former educator.
I did not feel that my health was at stake or anything. They distanced us. We did the social distancing. We did the sanitizer. They made sure they had enough people, you know, getting our information and then giving us the ballot. So we were not ever very close to other people.
Like Maria, most voters that I spoke to said they felt safe. Texas also has vote by mail available. We just don't know yet if that will be extended and included in the general elections in November.
Alejandra, are presidential candidates visibly campaigning in Texas? I mean, are you seeing that around the state?
President Donald Trump visited Dallas early in June. This was shortly after the death of George Floyd. Trump was launching his in-person campaign here in Texas. And he came to Dallas and met with the faith community, business leaders, and law enforcement. This event was private and it was at a church. But outside of the church, many were not happy. Protesters were rallying the streets outside of the Gateway Church of North Dallas, where the group met. Also, Democratic candidate Joe Biden just this week rolled out TV ads across Texas. We have to remember that, you know, Texas hasn't voted for a Democratic presidential candidate in over 40 years. It will be really interesting to see what these efforts that Biden is doing is going to lead to.
Now, for this series we're doing, Every 30 Seconds, we're following young Latino voters. What are you hearing from some of those voters in Texas?
My first impression was, where are the Latinos? You know, I didn't see many Latinos out voting on Tuesday for these runoff elections. But we have to keep in mind that I was only in a small area of Texas for a short period of time. Besides all of that, one of my biggest takeaways was that many Latino families see voting and going to vote as a family activity. Again, we go back to the Latina voter that I talked about earlier, Maria Cruz. House, she came out with her two daughters. And while her daughters are not first-time voters, they're still young. One daughter, her name's Susana Cruz, she's 39, and she put it this way.
It's really important for us as, like, Latinas to get out and vote. This is definitely was a priority today, and we were coming out to make sure that we chose people that were going to be representing us locally.
Did either Susana or her mother say who they're going to vote for in November?
They did not share who they were going to vote for, but they did tell me that some of the issues that matter the most to them are education and healthcare.
What else are you learning from these conversations?
Another takeaway from these runoff elections is that Latinos respond to candidates that they can relate to. And one of the candidates for Congress in North Texas, for example, Candace Valenzuela, won the Democratic nomination for Texas' 24th Congressional District. This district includes Dallas, Denton, and Tarrant County, so North Texas. And she won with 60% of the vote. This victory would put Valenzuela on track to becoming the first Afro-Latina in Congress if she wins in November. And throughout her campaign, Valenzuela made her identity as an Afro-Latina central to her candidacy. This is how she would relate to voters and younger voters. So Latinos are definitely paying attention when, you know, candidates are really trying to resonate with them.
That's Alejandra Martinez, reporter at KERA in Dallas. She's part of our Every 30 Seconds series. Alejandra, thank you.
Thank you.
And finally today, the United Arab Emirates is scheduled to launch a spacecraft tomorrow. The mission is called Hope to Mars. It's the first interplanetary journey ever taken by an Arab nation. The $200 million project to launch a satellite is the culmination of 6 years of work by Emirati scientists with help from the U.S. The mission's lead scientist is Sarah Almiri. She told the BBC they've been preparing for launch day for a long time.
We've tested and tested and tested the spacecraft to ensure that it can survive every single scenario. And now all of that rests on a launch pad on top of a rocket that's destined to a planet that's millions of kilometers away from us.
Takeoff, which is happening at a launch pad on an island off Japan, is all dependent on the weather, though. Scheduled liftoff yesterday was postponed because conditions were not quite right. There also might be a bit of a traffic jam getting up to Mars. NASA is launching a rover for the Red Planet this month. So is China. The aim of the UAE's mission is to find out more about Mars' atmosphere and how it became the dusty place it's known to be. But it's going to be some time before that research gets underway. It will take the satellite until next year to reach the planet. That coincides nicely with the UAE's 50th anniversary of its founding. Quite an accomplishment for the young nation. Here's another one. 80% of the Emirati science team are women. Sarah Almiri says the mission is about much more than just reaching Mars.
For children at school today, this mission has opened up new opportunities for all of us to work in designing and developing a planetary exploration mission. This is something that we couldn't fathom could have been possible to work in the UAE.
If the weather cooperates, you can catch tomorrow's launch of Hope to Mars on a live webcast. And that's the end of our countdown today. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston. But you can always find us online at theworld.org. I'm Carol Hills, back with you tomorrow for more stories from around our planet and beyond.